Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Emily Reddy. A recent conference by the Rock Ethics Institute at Penn State brought researchers into the ethics of policing to State College. Franklin Zimring from the University of California, Berkeley, studies police use of lethal force in the United States. Veshla Weaver from Johns Hopkins University studies how contact with the criminal justice system affects political engagement. And Michael Walzer from the Institute for Advanced Study studies the differences between police and soldiers. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So, Frank Zimring, let me start with you. Your book, When Police Kill, looks at police use of lethal force in the United States. Police kill about 1,000 Americans every year. And that's a number we haven't known for very long, right?
That is exactly twice as many deaths every year in the United States as three different federal agencies had been reporting for 50 years. And that means that the first year that we're really sure we know how many killings there were in the United States is 2015. We're pretty sure that rates have been stable prior to that, but we only got good data when we started looking on the internet and double-checking all these federal programs that we had, and it's not 1,000 killings a year. There are 1,000 deaths by shootings from police officers a year. The best count of total killings in police custody or in conflict with the police was the Guardians, and it was about 1,140. So that's three a day.
News sources like The Guardian and Washington Post have been at the forefront of that actual counting.
And of course, what it was that while this is a chronic problem in the United States and the rates are probably stable, it took a public reaction that started in 2014, that the problem has been around forever and has been uniquely concentrated in the United States. But the concern about the problem, other than in communities of color, is pretty much a byproduct of the last 3 years of American life.
And you also looked at who are these people who the police are shooting.
Sure. When you get a good count, you find out a lot of things. First of all, three a day, and you know it's not a few bad cops. And you also know it's not a few rogue departments. You have spread killings by police rather evenly across the country. Big cities, small towns, rural areas. And in every case, not only do you know that there's vastly more lethal force by police, but you also know that police are in more danger from citizen assaults in the United States than in any other developed country. About 50 officers a year die in the United States. The average year in the United Kingdom is no officers die. The average year in Germany is no officers die. In a bad year, there's one.
And why is that? Is it just about guns?
Just about guns. There are lots of ways that citizens kill other citizens. When you look at homicide rates by type of weapon, guns are about 67%. When you look at what kills police officers, 97.5% of all the killings of police officers in the 6 years that we studied them were guns. So it is the exclusive threat to life. There were 275 killings of police officers in the 6 years we studied. 268 of them were gunfire deaths. Two were bombs. Two were pocket knives. Three were personal force. The police officer hit his head. It is all guns, and the distribution of who police officers shoot is largely not about crime, but about where guns are and where disturbed people in disturbances might be having guns.
And your book starts with the 2014 shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Why that event? I mean, there have been shootings before. There have been shootings since. What was so important about that event?
Okay, well, what happened in the United States that was different? Whenever a police officer shoots a citizen, it's news. But it's local news as a single event. What happened, not just in the Michael Brown shooting, but as Ferguson became a focus for concern, other cases got melded in. And we began to generalize and see it wasn't that there was a 13-year-old in Cleveland, there was a case in more than one case in Baltimore. So that what happened is that finally the aggregate problem, the pattern rather than the event, became a matter of public concern. And this was literally for the first sustained period in American public life.
Feschler, Michael, do you want to chime in on this one? You know, the importance of that moment in Ferguson with the death of Michael Brown?
There's also been the enormous increase in SWAT raids, the so-called militarization of the police. Frank tells me that that hasn't actually increased the number of police killings, but it has given us a sense of the police, a different sense of the police. When small-town cops have a tank, it probably doesn't make them more dangerous, but it does make them more frightening.
You say that each year of these 1,000 deaths, you found that the average number that result in a felony conviction of a police officer is one.
That was Philip Stimson's work at Bowling Green University, and that's over the last 18 years. Partly the public consequences of this would be that we may go from one to two or three nationally. But that's two or three in 1,000. And the reason is the worse the police department, the more ambiguous the standards. Let's take Baltimore. That's one of the worst police departments in American urban life. The worse it is, the more singling out an individual officer and saying, Smith, this is your fault, makes no sense. What a good defense attorney does is put the rest of the police department on trial. And in a funny sense, that's not only good defense tactics, that's also true. Now, that means the criminal law is a lousy way to control it. It doesn't mean that this isn't easy to control. We could save 500 lives a year simply by forbidding police officers to use lethal force responding to attacks with weapons that don't kill police officers.
I'll throw this out to all of you. Is there a common threshold for police to meet before they use force, fear for their own safety or some such thing?
Oh, no. That I want to jump in and correct here. I teach lawyers. Mm-hmm. There are two vastly different questions, and Emily, you confounded them.
Okay.
One is when police can use force. Boy, the police officer's belt has got an awful lot of different kinds of force on it. Tasers are almost universal now for patrol officers.
So different kinds of force.
Sticks and partners are force, and more cops are force. Force is used millions and millions of times a year. Deadly force. Mm. And now we're talking about the police officers' use of guns. Is very special. Force can be used to effect arrests, to prevent escape, to do a lot of things. Deadly force, for the last 33 years, since Tennessee versus Garner was decided by the Supreme Court of the United States, can only be used where the police officer's life or another police officer's life or another citizen's life is at risk. Can't be used if people are escaping. So the standards, theoretically, have tightened. But the problem is that the problem has remained just as large. And if that's the real standard, then at least half of the killings we experience don't rise to that standard.
Right. What is
but
feeling
it's
at
deadly
risk.
Force.
Right.
That's a very special problem. Police use of force generally is a vast problem. It's concentrated in different ways. It's very different in big cities than small towns. It's much more concentrated on African American and minority populations.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. We're talking with Franklin Zimmering, Michael Walzer, and Veshla Weaver, who study the ethics of policing. Let me move on to Veshla. Your book, Arresting Citizenship, talks about how one-third of American adults have passed through the criminal justice system, includes those who were arrested but not convicted. What does that contact do to a person?
So when we started out on our academic journey to write this book, most of the kind of center of gravity in this area was, what are the effects of arrests on wages? What are the effects of having a conviction on job opportunities, on later mobility, even on neighborhood institutions, on the ability of a neighborhood to maintain social capital and to maintain what they call collective efficacy. And when Amy Lerman and I looked around, we didn't see anything thinking about how people begin to view the government. Most of this civic learning, learning about government, most of this political knowledge happens actually before a youth turns 14.
Hmm.
And so what, of course, do they learn from being stopped, patted down, thrown up against the hood of an officer car, witnessing others being treated in degrading ways, witnessing their parents being hauled off? I encountered one 12-year-old whose first time ever seeing a gun was seeing an officer point a gun at his own father's head. So you can imagine, this is a very dramatic, memorable moment of state-based humiliation, of a public authority meant to represent the people, meant to serve and protect, using the potential for violence. And what people in general learn is that the state doesn't care about me. The state is about dominance and hierarchy and control, not in the main about representing me or hearing my interests and preferences, right? Political scientists talk a lot about preferences and voting. And so in that condition, they develop distrust not just of police authorities, but of all governing authorities. It's what a sociologist named Sarah Brain calls system avoidance, that if you have an encounter, an arrest, a police stop, a conviction, you're less likely to make contact with other helping institutions that are government affiliated, right? You're less likely to go to your kid's school. You're less likely to seek out medical care when you're in dire need.
Maybe vote.
And so in my work, we find that it's not just economic-based penalties that happen from justice system involvement. It's a civic penalty. People become less likely to engage the political system even when they are legally eligible. So before we wrote this, there was a ton of attention on disenfranchisement, formal felon disenfranchisement, which is actually, it's not rare, but it's rarer than the informal withdrawal from the political system that happens from having a conviction. We found that even people who have been stopped by police are less likely to reach out to government when in need through 311 calls. They're less likely to enlist the police for help later on. They're less likely to reach out to a local civic organization. And that kind of systematic withdrawal from political institutions is deeply troubling in a democracy, right? You want people to be engaged. You want associational life to be thick. You want people to reach out to the police when in need. And so when people learn that the state has humiliated them, sees them as subjects, supplicants, not citizens, what do they do? In return, they retreat.
And I'm guessing that this is happening more with minority groups, African Americans, Hispanics, than with whites.
In our models, it's not that it happens more with one group. So if you look at whites who have had contact with the criminal justice system, the civic penalty, their withdrawal, is actually slightly higher than black and brown America. However, because the rates of contact are so much thicker, so much more intense in minority communities, the civic withdrawal is, in a relative sense, a bigger phenomenon.
And can you mentioned some sort of individual consequences, but do you see an impact on wider society as a whole?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think in middle-class, affluent, suburban areas, people do not learn that the government is centrally about surveillance authority, right? When I interact with the government, it may be at tax time. It may be because a canvasser came around to my doorstep. That is primarily my interaction with the public sector. Maybe if the city picks up my garbage. In areas where the surveillance system is strong, your first interaction with government is not going and getting your driver's license. Your first interaction with government is not casting your vote on election day or signing up for military service. Your first interaction is with the officers that Frank is talking about, who have the capacity to end your life. That's a way of hedging a little bit on your question, but to say that actually the wider effects, part of what's so damning about this system is that one group does not learn that government is about controlling and harassing and seeing them as suspects. My government sees me as a rights-bearing citizen. I don't learn at age 11 that my body can be physically harmed. Many youth have, empirical models show this, most adolescents at some point commit something that could be deemed running afoul of the law. And most people do not have the expectation in middle-class white communities of police contact from running afoul of the law. Now, one of the things that I've recently done, and I think that we really need to have a conversation about, is what we have found has transpired over the past four decades, since the late 1970s, is that people coming of age in the late 1970s in general fell in the right diagonal. In other words, yes, I did a crime, yes, I was arrested, or no, I didn't do a crime, and no, I never had contact with state authorities. Over time, those boxes have shifted, and much of our American population falls in the bad, illegitimate diagonal. Yes, I did a crime. No, I was not arrested. No, I didn't do a crime. Yes, I had contact with police. Involuntary contact with police. So what does that mean? This is getting to your question about what are the larger effects. What does that mean in a society predicated on, if I don't do something illegal, I should be left alone. I should be left unharmed.
You mentioned the 70s. I'm wondering if this comes back to what Michael was talking about with the rise of the SWAT team, that era. What has created this state of policing?
Well, the war on drugs has done a lot to do that, and the political popularity of the war on drugs. But I'm interested here at this conference in the rules of engagement for police. The question you asked before, mm-hmm. when should they use a lethal,
and maybe from a more of an ethical point, because I think that's a lot of
what
your research
is. Right, I'm a political theorist. I don't do empirical research. I read Frank Zimring. 7 years before the Tennessee v. Garner, the International Association of Police Chiefs voted 4-1 that it was right that an officer had a right to shoot a fleeing suspect. Tennessee v. Garner said no, but with a big exception, if the officer thinks the fleeing suspect is dangerous to himself, which is hard to believe that a fleeing suspect is a danger to the cop from whom he's fleeing, but to others. And many officers interpret that to mean if they think the fleeing suspect is armed, they can shoot. Now, soldiers can shoot fleeing enemy soldiers because the assumption is that they are trying to rejoin their unit and to resume the battle. That's the rule in the zone of war. In the zone of peace, the rule should be don't shoot, because in the zone of peace, the fleeing suspect is no more a danger to public safety than he was an hour earlier before the police tried to apprehend him. So that's one example of the difference. The rules for police have to be much more restrictive than the rules for soldiers. Another example, soldiers can make proportionality calculations. This military target is so important that I can kill a certain number of civilians and it's not disproportionate to the value of the military target. And that's called collateral damage, and it happens all the time. Police are not allowed to make proportionality calculations. They cannot say this fleeing suspect is so important that I can kill 3 innocent bystanders in order to catch him. They can't make calculations of that kind. Similarly, every killing of a civilian by a soldier is supposed to be investigated. For the police, every killing should be investigated. In Tennessee v. Garner, it was a 15-year-old black kid suspected of burglarizing a home. He was found to have $10 in his pocket, and he was shot running away. And the justification was, well, we have to do that in order to encourage people to surrender peacefully. The rule should be don't shoot.
The name of this conference is The Ethics of Policing. Is the ethics of how they do policing something that you've heard police talk about, or that you think they talk about at all?
I've talked to some retired policemen, and I had a long talk with the chief of police in Princeton, who is one of the good guys. When he became chief of police, he took away their machine guns. It's a small move. Some police really believe that they are at war. And cops have said to me things like, it's like Vietnam out there, referring to Newark or Trenton or... it's not. One of the things we have to insist on is that criminals are not enemies. Those are very different categories. Criminals are fellow citizens with rights.
I'll ask you all a last question. What is the one biggest thing that could be done to make policing better, safer for citizens?
Well, for lethal force, it's easy. Clear, unambiguous, and empirically based rules from the police chief to the officers saying, don't shoot in these 10 situations and stop shooting in these 5. And that by itself could save hundreds of lives, which is why I'm here for a police ethics conference, because I don't understand why police chiefs don't feel under the ethical obligation to ask themselves whether their rules meet that criteria.
Veshla.
I'm going to say something a little bit different, and this isn't a specific policy proposal, but it's something I think our society needs to move toward, and that is to make all police contact with people under the age of 18 a very last resort. Hmm. We've done it with juvenile institutions. So most people don't realize this, but we've shuttered many juvenile correctional institutions across the United States, so much so that even conservative states have 1 or 2 remaining juvenile prisons. Did it with little fanfare. The argument was that the adolescent brain is not developed until 26. You know, we let folks that are 26 stay on their parents' health care, right?
Yeah.
And given that most, I think people don't realize this, most contact with the criminal justice system, at least at this low level, police contacts that may not result in arrest, they may not result in a conviction, are an incredible gateway to later contact and to disrupting a adolescent life course. So scholars like Jeff Fagan have found huge diminishments in test scores and grades that happen from just one police encounter. If we can minimize that contact with police that happens before the age of 18, we will starve the beast. Even before Philando Castile was felled by police, he had 61 contacts in just a few years with police. That is also state violence. That is also a system that disregards people's ability to live free. So if we can cut that, greatly reduce it, make it a last resort, wall off youth from police contact, I think we will achieve a big victory.
Michael.
Yeah, well, there's a saying that military justice is like military music. It's not music, it's not justice. But the military courts, for all their deficiencies, and they are very deficient, are probably better at holding soldiers accountable than anything we do with the police. So one of the things that would help a great deal is to hold officers accountable for what they do, not only for killings, but for injuries. Even a small increase in the one indictment would change police behavior considerably.
Thank you all for talking with us.
Thanks for having us, Emily.
Franklin Zimring, Veshla Weaver, and Michael Walzer study the ethics of policing. I'm Emily Reddy, WPSU.